Then you've got to work up the data and write the papers as sort of penance to be able to go out to sea again the next year. George Abbey interrupted her just as she was describing how, in the middle of the storm, in the middle of the night, a critical piece of research equipment had busted. She'd had to haul it into the boat in the darkness and inspect each segment. The oceanographer in charge of the expedition had watched her labor for the first few hours but finally turned grumpy. "Just fix the damn thing," he said, and gone to bed.
"So what did you do?" Abby asked her.
"What do you mean, what did I do?" she said. "We fixed it."
"And then you went to bed?" he asked.
I felt like saying, "No, you idiot, I did not go to bed." Instead, she explained that she had stayed up for 2 more hours to make sure her fix held in the storm. Later, NASA had her take a Myers-Briggs-type personality test. Like virtually all the astronauts, but unlike roughly 85% of the American population, she profiled as a mission-driven person. The mission-driven type was overrepresented in the astronaut population, she said, whereas more dreamer or salesman-type folks are very underrepresented. From the original 8,000 or so applicants, NASA selected 35 to become astronauts. 6 were women, all scientists. A lot of the men were indeed former fighter pilots. They tended to see themselves as the main event and, at least at first, looked upon the women scientists assigned to accompany them as a sideshow. Kathy wasn't shy about expressing her thoughts on this subject. "You know, you're just my taxi driver," she told one of the pilots. "My job is the interesting part of this mission." He didn't like it, but the space program was changing. "By the time I got to it," she said, "it had gone from just proving you could get there and come home alive to, what are we doing here?" What they were doing in space was what she sensed she'd been put on Earth to do. Explore, gather data, and make sense of it. The science was 3 big things, she said. Bullet point 1, using space as a platform to look back at Earth and out into the cosmos, getting a different point of view. There is a kind of understanding of this planet that space alone makes possible. Bullet point 2. What do we need to know that we don't know about living in space? Bullet point 3. How does the human body respond to being sprung from the force of gravity? How do fluids flow? How does the body behave? What had grabbed her attention from the start was the Earth science. The snapshot that might be taken of Earth from above, of the current conditions on Earth that were going to be crucial to mankind's understanding of its environment. "I was all about bullet point 1," said Kathy. She couldn't just skip the other bullet points, however. She might see her job as gathering data about the planet, but a lot of other people saw their jobs as gathering data about her. They now had another kind of human body to study, though it was reluctant. "I was moderately disinterested in being a lab rat." It didn't help. The engineers at the heart of the space program had some strange notions about women. For instance, that they were more vulnerable to rapid decreases in pressure. The Air Force worked with this aerospace medical unit, she said. They'd concluded that the women were more likely to experience the bends when the pressure went from high to low. "They think they've detected a higher instance of damage to the central nervous system. They tell them I'm going to die," she thought. "You guys don't have enough data, and the data you have, you've handled badly." She pointed out that female deep-sea divers didn't experience any special problems at lower depths. It was an open question as to which was more mysterious to a male NASA engineer, outer space or the American female. They appeared to have better data on outer space. They had prepared makeup kits for their space shuttles, for instance, even though Kathy and a couple of the other women didn't wear makeup. They set out to design flame-retardant, one-size-fits-all bras and underpants, until the women explained that the one-size-fits-all approach used for men's underwear wasn't going to work with women's underwear. In the end, the women won the right to buy their own flame-retardant underwear. And how would a woman urinate in space? The engineers worried about that one for a while. The male astronauts had been fitted with condom catheters. But these were always threatening to leak or even burst and obviously wouldn't work for women. To everyone's relief, a NASA engineer created an extra absorbent polymer and worked it into a diaper that could be worn by all. In the bargain, he'd anticipated the baby diapers of the future. And of course, the male engineers were seriously worried about what might ensue if a woman had her period in space.
The idea that women might menstruate in orbit drove the whole place up a wall, said Kathy. The male world's response was, oh, that's okay, we'll just suppress their periods. We all looked at each other and said, you and what other army, buddy? The engineers finally agreed to pack tampons in the supply kits. The first time Kathy opened her kit, she saw that each tampon had been removed from its paper wrapper and sealed in a plastic fireproof case. Heat-sealed tampons. Each plastic case was connected to another. She pulled on the top one, and out pops this great long chain of little red plastic cases, like a string of firecrackers. Hundreds of tampons for one woman to survive for a few days in space. It was like a bad stage act, she said. There just seemed this endless unfurling of Lord only knows how many tampons. The engineers eventually sat down with the female astronauts to discuss the matter. Would 100 be the right number, they asked. Kathy Sullivan worried that NASA might use the differences between their bodies as an excuse to write different rules for males and females. The male astronauts, on the other hand, adapted pretty quickly to the presence of women. The guy she'd been assigned to walk with in space was Dave Liestma. They'd had a moment together that captured the spirit of their interaction. They had started training in their spacesuits. Step one was to remove their clothes and put on the first layer of the 225-pound suit, the liquid cooling and ventilation garment. The test chamber was full of male engineers. I have this fleeting sense that everyone has just realized that we're about to go boldly where no man has gone before. There's a woman in this mix, said Kathy, in the NASA oral history. So I looked over at Dave and said, Dave, let me tell you my philosophy about modesty in circumstances like this. He shifts a bit and says, okay. I said, I have none. He said, fine. We start peeling off clothes. Kathy couldn't have been less interested in a gender drama. She just wanted to go to space and see it for myself, not in a magazine picture. She wanted to get on with the mission, which was why she never complained about her spacesuit. It was small, medium, large kind of thing, not a custom fit kind of thing, she said. My knee was never in the knee of the suit. The suits were always stiff and took real muscle to move. Whenever I had to bend my legs, I had to overcome this extra leverage. By the time she realized that her suit was never going to fit, NASA had asked her to wear it. I was not going to turn this into, see, we told you she'd be all this extra trouble. I decided, we're just sucking this up. But really, her spacesuit should have come with a warning label. In a test chamber, a NASA engineer had flipped the switch that enabled the spacesuit's emergency oxygen tank, and the suit had exploded in a giant fireball. If you're doing some weird test that's unlike anything that you normally do, it would still get your full attention, Kathy said later. But this was like saying that when you step on the gas of your car, it's going to explode. Highly discomforting. It was now October 11th, 1984. The Challenger was in orbit, with her inside it, waiting to walk in space. The air was gone from the airlock. When they simulated this moment back on Earth, they put a baking pan with water on the floor to illustrate what might happen to your body's fluids if something went wrong with your suit. As the pressure dropped, the water would bubble violently, as if it were boiling. But then a couple of seconds later, it would flash freeze into ice crystals. Poof! Don't open your visor, they said. On a mission this complicated, it was actually impossible to imagine everything that might kill you. The O-rings of the very spacecraft in whose airlock she now floated would soon become the most famous illustration of the point. Just 15 months later, the failure of NASA to heed engineers' warnings about how brittle the rings that sealed the solid rocket boosters could become in the cold would lead the boosters to leak and the Challenger to blow up, killing all the astronauts on board. Later, when someone asked her why it never seemed to occur to her to be afraid, Kathy had an answer. In college, she'd gone bushwhacking with a boyfriend around the Grand Canyon. They'd hacked a trail in a bad place, and they now had to jump onto a narrow ledge or go tumbling down a steep slope. The slightest misstep, and she would fall to her death. I mean, my knees are wobbling and shaking, and I remember thinking, not now. Then she was fine. She'd discovered an emotional talent. She had the ability to decide not to be afraid. All the astronauts had it, she noticed. If you are scared, I don't want you to be there, she said. Be here, now. Here, now. This is the game. Be scared before, be scared later, not during. Inside her spacesuit, with the pressure gone from the Challenger's airlock, she felt no change at all, and that struck her here as strange, just as it had on Earth. I always thought, isn't this room supposed to look different when it has no air in it? But there's no difference. She moved along a handrail to open the hatch. She poked her head out into space. Then she reached out and tethered herself to the hook on the outside of the capsule before untethering herself from the hook inside the airlock. Mountaineering 101. With her body traveling at 17,500 miles per hour, she set out, hand over hand, to demonstrate that it was indeed possible to refuel a satellite in orbit. With that, she became the first American woman to walk in space. That first step would shadow her for the rest of her life. President Reagan would invite her to a dinner at the White House and sit her beside him. Corporations would offer her high-paying jobs. Civic organizations across the country would offer her awards and ask her to come and tell her story. Seemingly all of Long Island would soon be in touch, because at some point in space, she had looked down. How could she not? And shouted, "Hey, there's Long Island." She had a choice of how to play her experience. "You can dine out on this stuff forever," she said. But that was feeling shallow to me. I wanted to make the experience matter. The same internal process that had led her to decline the role of girl made it possible for her to pass on the role of lady astronaut. She flew twice more into space, orbited Earth a few hundred more times, and then, in the early 1990s, went looking for something else to do. She now had a measure of celebrity and needed to make a decision about how best to use it. She wanted another mission that felt as important as the one she'd just completed. She wanted to do Earth science, and she wanted the stakes of the science to be high. That wasn't surprising. What was surprising was where she finally found her mission: the United States Department of Commerce. Around the same time, DJ Patil also wandered into the Commerce Department, though in truth he didn't know it. Physically, he was sitting at a desk on the campus of the University of Maryland, pursuing his PhD in mathematics. He'd found a security hole in the U.S. government's computers, and he reached through it to grab what he needed. What he needed was a very specific pile of data. That it, like much of the rest of the government's data, resided in the Department of Commerce, he hadn't bothered to figure out. DJ had come to Maryland from California to study with James York, a professor who had coined the term chaos theory. The idea was simple. Some small, barely noticed event can cascade into huge consequences down the road. The day your parents met, for instance, what if that hadn't happened? A lot of the drama in his life, DJ traced back to a small, little-noticed event in his early childhood, a tendency to reverse the order of numbers. When you see 16 as 61, you have problems in school. Struggling with his assigned tasks, he diverted himself with unassigned ones. Watching spy movies, he became intrigued with picking locks. He'd pick his way into other kids' lockers, move the stuff around inside, then lock them back up, just to freak them out. Then he learned how to pick people's pockets for fun. He'd take the car keys off some unsuspecting grown-up, move his car, then return the keys to the guy's jacket pocket. In the eighth grade, he hacked the English teacher's computer and changed the grades and never got caught. In ninth grade, a prank gone wrong set an entire hillside in a well-to-do Silicon Valley neighborhood on fire. DJ ended up listening to a cop read him his rights. The landowner agreed not to prosecute if DJ agreed to spend the next few months at hard labor, restoring the hillside. While he was doing that, he got himself suspended from his English class for exploding a stink bomb, and a few months after that from math class for... At that point, it hardly mattered. By the time he graduated from high school, after a merciful school administrator changed an F on his transcript to a C, he wasn't the only one who might look at DJ and see JD. At De Anza Community College, he stumbled into a calculus class and liked it. More than liked it, he realized he had a gift for it. The calculus class was another small life event that wound up having big effects. By the time he arrived in Maryland to pursue his PhD, he was still interested in math, but not so much as he was in what might be done with it, to study a lot of otherwise inexplicable things that happened in life and nature. I was always in love with the patterns in nature, he said, and what I needed were the tools to understand them, and for me, math was the most sensible. All sorts of natural phenomena might be modeled and understood with chaos theory. The collapse of the sardine population off the California coast, for example, or the bizarre long landslides that occurred in the Mojave Desert, where the rocks ended up inexplicably far from where they'd started, given the slope of their journey. These long run-out landslides are crazy. The question is, how did the rocks end up so far away? In theory, the new math might explain it. In practice, there wasn't enough data on the movement of the rocks or the sardine holocaust for him or anyone else to study them effectively. The same went for traffic jams, the boom-bust cycles in the wolf and deer populations in the American West, and countless other big events triggered by surprisingly small ones. Then he happened upon the weather. He'd always been interested in it, but never thought of it as something he might study until he discovered that the U.S. government was sitting on a huge trove of weather data. It resided inside something called the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which was in turn inside the Department of Commerce. But he didn't have any idea of that yet. He was just roaming around servers within the U.S. government, the sole supplier of the data he needed if he was going to get his Ph.D. The only place I could get the data was the weather. Since the end of the Second World War, weather data collection has become one of the greatest illustrations of the possibilities of global collaboration and public-spiritedness. Every day, thousands of amateur weather observers report data to their governments, as do a lot of experts aboard commercial planes in the sky and on ships at sea. Every day, twice a day, almost 900 weather balloons are released from 900 different spots on the globe, 92 of them by the U.S. government. A half dozen countries, including the United States, deploy thousands of buoys to collect weather from the ocean surface. Then there's the data collected by billion-dollar satellites and fancy radar stations. In the United States alone, the National Weather Service maintains 159 high-resolution Doppler radar sites. The United States shares its weather data with other countries, just as other countries share their weather data with the United States. But back in 1996, when DJ was hacking the Department of Commerce computer servers, weather data was not generally available to even the most enterprising hacker. It wasn't open to the public, said DJ, but it turned out there was a hole. What came through that hole was such a vast trove of information that it overwhelmed the capacity of the computers in the University of Maryland's math department. So DJ hunted for other computers at the university he might use. You can get historical data and play with it, he said. It was the original idea of the internet. I was that guy. I didn't have a supercomputer, so I just had to steal that, too. He'd start work at 8 every night, when no one else was using the computers, and go until 7 the next morning. He cobbled together enough storage to hold his borrowed treasure. That was my academic claim to fame, he said, that I downloaded the Weather Service's data. As he looked at the data, a couple of things became apparent. First, that the weather forecasts were improving more dramatically than he'd imagined. No one else was paying much attention to this, but for the first time in history, the weatherman was becoming useful. Before the Second World War, meteorology had been a bit like medicine in the 19th century. The demand for expertise was so relentless that the supply had no choice but to make fraudulent appearances. Right through the 1970s, the weather forecaster would look at the available weather information and, relying heavily on his judgment and personal experience, offer a prediction. His vision typically extended no more than 36 hours into the future, and even then it was blurry. Snow will fall somewhere over these three states. For a very long time, the weather had been only theoretically predictable. That is, people had some pretty good ideas about how it might be predicted, without being able actually to predict it. Around the time DJ began downloading it, the weather data had led to practical progress that shocked even the theoreticians. On March 12, 1993, what became known as the storm of the century hit the eastern United States. Its force was incredible. Waves in the Gulf of Mexico sank a 200-foot ship. Roofs across southern states collapsed under the weight of the snow. Tornadoes killed dozens of people. Travel ceased along the entire eastern seaboard. But the biggest difference between this storm and those that had come before it was that it had been predicted by a model. Following a segment on CBS Evening News about the siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, Louis Uccellini, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, had warned of the coming massive threat. The TV hosts had treated the nation's weatherman with amusement. They ended the story by saying, "The weatherman is usually wrong." But this time he wasn't. The National Weather Service had relied on its forecasting model, with no human laying hands on the results, and it had predicted the location and severity of the storm 5 days before it hit. It was unheard of, said Uccellini. When I started in the 1970s, the idea of predicting extreme events was almost forbidden. How can you see a storm before the storm can be seen? This time, states declared an emergency before the first flake of snow. It was just amazing for us to watch. We sat there, wrapping our heads around what we'd done. 6 years after the storm, Uccellini described the advances in weather prediction from about the end of World War II as one of the major intellectual achievements of the 20th century. The achievements received surprisingly little attention, perhaps because they were, at least at first, difficult to see. It was not as if one day the weather could not be predicted, and the next it could be predicted with perfect accuracy. What was happening was a shift in the odds that the weather forecast was right. It was the difference between an ordinary blackjack player and a blackjack player who was counting the cards. Over time, the skill means beating rather than losing to the house. But at any given moment, it is impossible to detect. DJ could see that this progress was a big deal, a world historic event. Here you could see chaos theory dramatized, but in reverse. You could rewind history and consider how things might have come out differently if our ability to predict the weather had been even a tiny bit better or worse. The failed hostage rescue in Iran was caused by a sandstorm we didn't see coming, said DJ. The Kosovo offensive was so effective because we knew we wouldn't have cloud cover. You could pick almost any extreme weather event and imagine a different outcome for it, if only people had known it was coming. The hurricane that struck Galveston, Texas back in 1900, before anyone thought to name such storms, had struck without warning and killed so many people that no one ever figured out exactly how many had died. Maybe 6,000 or maybe 12,000. What their grandchildren would know about the weather might have saved them all.
Here was yet another illustration of chaos in life. Even slight changes in our ability to predict the weather might have fantastic ripple effects. The weather itself was chaotic. Some slight change in the conditions somewhere on the planet could lead to huge effects elsewhere. The academic meteorologists around DJ knew this. The question was what to do about it. The Department of Meteorology at the University of Maryland, as it happened, had led a new movement in forecasting and spurred the National Weather Service to change its approach to its own models. Before December 1992, the meteorologists had simply plugged the data they had into their forecasting model, wind speeds, barometric pressure, ocean temperatures, and so on. But most of the planet's weather went unobserved. There was no hard data. As a result, many of the model's inputs were just estimates. You didn't actually know the wind speed or barometric pressure or humidity or anything else at every spot on the planet. An idea pursued at Maryland and a couple of other places was to run the weather model over and over with different initial weather conditions. Alter the conditions slightly in reasonable ways. Vary the wind speed or barometric pressure at 10,000 feet, or the ocean temperature, or whatever seemed reasonable to vary. How you did this was its own art. Do it 20 times and you wind up with 20 different forecasts. A range of forecasts generated a truer prediction of the weather than a single forecast, because it captured the uncertainty of each one. Instead of saying, "Here's where the hurricane is going," or "We have no idea where the hurricane is going," you could say, "We don't know for sure where the hurricane might go, but we have a cone of probability you can use to make your decisions." Ensemble forecasting, the new technique was called. It implied that every weather forecast, and not just hurricanes, should include a cone of uncertainty. Why they don't is a great question. "There's a storm coming on Saturday" means one thing if all the forecasts in the ensemble say the storm is coming. It means another if some of the forecasts say there is no chance of rain on Saturday, and others say that a storm is all but certain. Really, the weather prediction should reflect this uncertainty. Why is the newspaper always giving us a 5-day forecast? Asked DJ. It should be a 2-day forecast sometimes, and it should be a 14-day forecast other times. By the time DJ discovered the security hole in the government's database, the National Weather Service had taken to ensemble forecasting and was generating a dozen or more forecasts for each day. On some days, the forecasts would be largely in agreement. Slight changes in the estimates of current weather conditions did not lead to big changes in the future weather. At other times, they varied radically. That is, sometimes the weather was highly chaotic and sometimes not. DJ quickly saw that instability was not in any way linked to severity. A Category 5 hurricane might keep on being a Cat 5 hurricane without a whole lot of doubt. Then other times it wouldn't. Why in the case of one storm are the forecasts all the same, and in the case of another they are all different? He asked. Why was the weather sometimes highly predictable and other times less so? Or as DJ put it, why does a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil cause or not cause a tornado in Oklahoma? With the government's data, he was able to contribute a new idea, that the predictability of the weather might itself be quantified. We all know the weather is chaotic, he said. The question is, how chaotic? You should be able to assess when a forecast is likely to go seriously bad versus when the weather is stable. In the end, his thesis created a new statistic, how predictable the weather was at any given moment. When he defended his thesis in the summer of 2001, he was surprised by what the U.S. government's data had enabled him to do. As a grad student, you're just like, I hope I have something that doesn't suck. You don't actually expect your stuff to work. He wasn't a meteorologist, yet he'd found new ways to describe the weather. He'd also found, in himself, a more general interest in data. What else might it be used to discover? The relevance of that ambition became a bit clearer after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. There was a sense that this was, among other things, a failure of data analysis, he said. If we had known how to distinguish signal from noise, we'd have seen it and prevented it. Hey, why are all these guys suddenly taking flight lessons? The assassin's use of credit cards alone, properly analyzed, would have revealed they were up to no good. The image of a good network is messy, said DJ. It's really hard to fake messiness. It's hard to fake being an American with a credit card. The big question now in DJ's world was, how, using data, do you identify threats to U.S. interests? By this time, a young postdoc at Maryland, he attended a talk by a guy who ran something called the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. The agency, inside the U.S. Department of Defense, was charged with defending the country against weapons of mass destruction. It was trying to understand terrorist networks so it might disrupt them. I hear the talk and I was like, wait a second, DJ recalled. The idea that if you push a network a certain way, it might collapse. Is the network stable or unstable? It's a lot like the question I was asking about weather forecasts. A terrorist network, like a thunderstorm, might be chaotic. Terrorist networks, along with a lot of other security matters, might be better understood through chaos theory. If you pull out a node in a terrorist cell, does it collapse? Or the opposite? How do we design our electricity grid so that if you take out a node, it does not collapse? Thinking they would make use of his data skills, he went to work at the Department of Defense, where he expected to look for patterns in terrorist networks. But instead of sticking him at a computer, his new employer shipped him off to a couple of former Soviet republics to track and understand the stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons left behind by the Russians. They tell me, we need you to go to Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and I'm like, I'm a mathematician. That was the first question I asked. Why me? They said, hey, you're a doctor. And I said, I'm not that kind of doctor. And they said, close enough, you'll figure it out. After that, they sent him to Iraq to help rebuild the school system. All of the work was interesting, and a lot of it useful, but it didn't have much to do with his deep ambition. People still didn't really appreciate how you can use data to transform, he said. To his surprise, This was true even of people back home where he had grown up, in Silicon Valley, to which he soon returned. Even there, he couldn't get a job doing what he wanted to do with data. "I was just trying to figure out where I could be helpful," he said. "Google passed on me. Yahoo passed on me." His mom knew someone at eBay, and so he finally was hired the undignified way. At eBay, he tried and failed to persuade his superiors to let him use the data on hand to find new ways to detect fraud. At length, he moved to a new, slow-growing company called LinkedIn, where job seekers posted their CVs and attempted to create their own little networks. His new bosses asked him to be head of analytics and data product teams. There, for the first time, he found an audience receptive to his pitch. "The same tools you use to identify where bad guys are, you can do with job skills," he said. "You can show people where skills cluster, where they might belong in the economy. If you're trained in the army in ordnance disposal, maybe you'd be good at mining." The analytics he'd created at LinkedIn had done exactly that, prodded an army bomb expert to find work setting explosives in mines, along with much more. In the space of a few years, the interest in data analysis went from curiosity to fad. The fetish for data overran everything from political campaigns to the management of baseball teams. Inside LinkedIn, DJ presided over an explosion of job titles that described similar tasks: analyst, business analyst, data analyst, research sci. The people in human resources complained to him that the company had too many data-related job titles. The company was about to go public, and they wanted to clean up the organization chart. To that end, DJ sat down with his counterpart at Facebook, who was dealing with the same problem. What could they call all these data people? "Data scientist," his Facebook friend suggested. "We weren't trying to create a new field or anything, just trying to get HR off our backs," said DJ. He replaced the job titles for some openings with "data scientist." To his surprise, the number of applicants for the jobs skyrocketed. Data scientists were what people wanted to be. In the fall of 2014, someone from the White House called him. Obama was coming to San Francisco and wanted to meet with him. He'd seen the power of data in his campaign, said DJ, and he knew there was a new opportunity to use it to transform the country. When the White House asked him if he wanted to bring his wife to the meeting, DJ figured that Obama was looking for more than a conversation. Inside of 8 years, he'd gone from being a guy who couldn't get a job in Silicon Valley to being a guy the President of the United States wanted to offer a job he couldn't refuse. When Obama did ask DJ to move to Washington, it was DJ's wife who responded. "How do we know if any of this will be of any use?" she asked. "If your husband is as good as everyone says he is, he'll figure it out," said Obama, which of course made it even harder for DJ to refuse. DJ went to Washington. His assignment was to figure out how to make better use of the data created by the U.S. government. His title? Chief Data Scientist of the United States. He'd be the first person to hold the job. He made his first call at the Department of Commerce to meet with Penny Pritzker, the Commerce Secretary, and Kathy Sullivan, the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They were pleased to see him, but also a bit taken aback that he had come. "They seemed a little surprised I was there," recalled DJ. "I said, 'I'm the data guy and you're the data agency. This is where a huge amount of the data is.' And they're like, 'Yes, but how did you know?'" Nobody understood what it did, but then, like so many United States government agencies, the Department of Commerce is seriously misnamed. It has almost nothing to do with commerce directly and is actually forbidden by law from engaging in business. But it runs the United States Census, the only real picture of who Americans are as a nation. It collects and makes sense of all the country's economic statistics, without which the nation would have very little idea of how it was doing. Through the Patent and Trademark Office, it tracks all the country's inventions. It contains an obscure but wildly influential agency called the National Institute of Standards and Technology, stuffed with Nobel laureates, which does everything from setting the standards for construction materials to determining the definition of a second and of an inch. It's more complicated than you might think, but of the roughly $9 billion spent each year by the Commerce Department, $5 billion goes to NOAA. And the bulk of that money is spent, one way or another, on figuring out the weather. Each and every day, NOAA collects twice as much data as is contained in the entire book collection of the Library of Congress. Commerce is one of the most misunderstood jobs in the cabinet, because everyone thinks it works with business, says Rebecca Blank, a former acting Commerce Secretary in the Obama administration, and now Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin. It produces public goods that are of value to business, but that's different. Every secretary who comes in thinks commerce does trade. But trade is maybe 10% of what commerce does, if that. The Department of Commerce should really be called the Department of Information, or maybe the Department of Data. Get to know the U.S. government had not been high on Donald Trump's to-do list, even after he learned that he'd be running it. On the Monday after the presidential election, the same thing that had happened across the rest of the U.S. government happened inside the Department of Commerce. Nothing. Dozens of civil servants sat all day waiting to deliver briefings that would, in the end, never be heard. They'd expected Trump's campaign organization to send in landing teams to learn about what was being done there and why. The problems that had been Obama's problems for the past 8 years were about to become Trump's problems. But his people didn't seem to want to know about them. They just didn't bring any bodies in at all, says a senior commerce official. There was just very little attention paid to any of the pieces. The census, they just didn't seem interested in knowing any of that. It all seemed to be about trade, or the size of a commerce workforce. Right up until early January, no one turned up at NOAA to figure out who should run the place and how they would run it. But at the end of November, Trump nominated Wilbur Ross, a 79-year-old Wall Street billionaire, to be the next Secretary of Commerce. A few weeks later, Ross came in for a single meeting with Penny Pritzker. He came by himself, recalled one of the people who greeted him. I was shocked. Just this very old guy all by himself. And it was pretty clear he had no idea what he was getting into, and he had no help. He also soon had a problem. $2 billion or so missing dollars. A Forbes reporter named Dan Alexander, studying the financial disclosure forms Ross had been required to file with the Office of Government Ethics, had been struck by the discrepancy between how much money Ross said he had and how much he told Forbes reporters that he had over the course of many years. How had $3.7 billion suddenly become $700 million? $3.7 billion is what Ross had told Forbes he was worth. He'd sent Forbes a list of his assets every year for the past 13 years so that he would qualify for the magazine's annual list of the 400 richest Americans. He'd always failed to answer Forbes' follow-up questions, and so the people at Forbes, who compiled the list, reduced the number to $2.9 billion, to be conservative about it. Alexander was now one of the Forbes staffers who compiled the magazine's rich list, and he had access to the Forbes files. I thought this was kind of odd, he said. It bugged me that it didn't add up. I called Ross up to see what he had to say about it, and he sounds like a credible guy. Ross claimed the explanation was simple. Between the election and the inauguration, he had simply given away $2 billion to a trust owned by his heirs. Alexander had first assumed that the scandal was that Wilbur Ross was hiding money from the U.S. government. But after pressing the Department of Commerce to fill in the giant holes in Ross's story, he realized that Ross had misled Forbes for 13 years. I went back in the files, said Alexander. We at Forbes had initially counted the money that belonged to his investors in one of his funds as his own money. I was stunned that anyone had let that slide. He lucked into a way to be on the list without deserving to be on the list. But once he gets on the list, he lies for years. The Forbes reporters were accustomed to having rich people mislead them about the size of their wealth. But nearly all of them had been trying to keep their names off the list. In the history of the magazine, only three people stand out as having made huge efforts to get on or end up higher than they belonged, said Alexander. One was Saudi Prince Al-Walid, the second was Donald Trump, and the third was Wilbur Ross. The scandal wasn't that Wilbur Ross was hiding $2 billion from the government, but that he'd never had the $2 billion in the first place. Alexander wrote up his findings, after which he says, I got a bunch of calls from people who had worked with or for Wilbur Ross to say how happy they were the truth finally came out. The former number three man at Ross's old firm, who had worked with Ross for 25 years, spoke on the record. Wilbur doesn't have an issue with bending the truth, he said. This was the man Trump had chosen to guard the integrity of the data on which our society rests. Yet inside the Department of Commerce, there came, in the spring of 2017, a ray of hope. In March, the Trump White House asked the help of a former senior climate policy advisor from the George W. Bush administration, who had actually worked for 8 years inside the Department of Commerce. They came into the Department of Commerce, said the former Bush official, and they discovered that it has got this thing in it called NOAA, and it's 60% of the Commerce Department budget. And they said, what the fuck is NOAA? The Bush official flew to Washington, D.C. to speak with Wilbur Ross about the place Ross was meant to have been running for the past several months. It's not the Department of Commerce, the Bush official told him in so many words. It's the Department of Science and Technology. It was a massive data-collecting enterprise, and the biggest collector of all was the National Weather Service. NOAA also regulated the fishing industry and mapped the ocean floor and maintained the fleet of ships and planes used in gathering information. It had collected climate and weather data going back to records kept at Monticello by Thomas Jefferson. Without that data, and the weather service that made sense of it, no plane would fly, no bridge would be built, and no war would be fought. At least not well. The weather data was also the climate data. If you don't believe in climate change, you at least want to understand the climate, said the Bush official. And if you wanted to understand the climate, you needed to take special care of NOAA's data. There was no way the Bush official could get across all he wanted to tell the new Commerce Secretary in a single meeting. NOAA is a beast, he said. It's 12,000 employees, and they are decentralized, out in these little tiny offices all over the country. But it does more to protect Americans than any other agency except for Homeland Security and the Department of Defense. The Bush official did get to tell Ross his main point about NOAA. It's incredible value, and everyone shits on it, he said. The people are great. They aren't in it for the money. They're in it for the mission. And he asked Ross a question. What's your philosophy for running the department? What do you mean? Asked Ross. It's not really the Department of Commerce, said the Bush official. Its mission is a science and technology mission. Yeah, I don't think I want to be focusing on that, said Ross. It was clear to me that he had not thought about what the science and technology meant, said the Bush official. He doesn't have a scientific bone in his body. That was totally okay. The Secretary of Commerce could continue to pretend to be the Secretary of Business. But he badly needed to put people in place under him who understood the science. The Bush official assumed he'd been brought in for just this reason, to help the new administration find the right person to run NOAA. He knew qualified Republicans inoffensive to Trump. He handed the Trump White House a list of half a dozen politically acceptable people who could do the job well enough. 6 months later, in October 2017, the White House announced its selection. Barry Myers. Barry Myers hadn't been anywhere near the Bush official's list. He was the CEO of AccuWeather, one of the first for-profit weather companies. It had been founded by his meteorologist brother, Joel Myers, back in 1962. A third brother helped to run the company, which employed other family members, including Barry Myers' wife, Holly. The company was still privately owned by the Myers family, so it was hard to know exactly how big it was, or how much money it made, or how it made it. Staffers in the U.S. Senate, charged with vetting Myers' nomination, estimated that AccuWeather had roughly $100 million a year in revenue, and that it came mainly from selling ads on its website and selling weather forecasts to companies and governments willing to pay for them. Some weather geeks had recently discovered that the company had been selling the locations of people using its app, even when these individuals had declined to give AccuWeather permission to do this. At any rate, at his U.S. Senate hearings, Barry Myers estimated his AccuWeather shares to be worth roughly $57 million. At first glance, the nomination made sense. A person deeply involved in weather forecasting was going to take over an agency that devoted most of its resources to understanding the weather. At second glance, both Barry Myers and AccuWeather were deeply inappropriate. For a start, Barry Myers wasn't a meteorologist or a scientist of any sort. He was a lawyer. I was originally enrolled in meteorology as an undergraduate, he told the Wall Street Journal back in 2014. I then dropped out of school because I was a horrible student. I was never interested in learning. which I look at now as sort of funny. Then there was AccuWeather. It had started out making its money by repackaging and selling National Weather Service information to gas companies and ski resorts. It claimed to be better than the National Weather Service at forecasting the weather. But what set it apart from everyone else was not so much its ability to predict the weather as to market it. As the private weather industry grew, AccuWeather's attempts to distinguish itself from its competitors became more outlandish. In 2013, for instance, it began to issue a 45-day weather forecast. In 2016, that became a 90-day weather forecast. We are in the realm of palm reading and horoscopes here, not science. Dan Satterfield, a meteorologist on CBS's Maryland affiliate, wrote, "This kind of thing should be condemned, and if you have an AccuWeather app on your smartphone, my advice is to stand up for science and replace it." Alone in the private weather industry, AccuWeather made a point of claiming that it had called storms missed by the National Weather Service. Here was a typical press release. On the evening of February 24, 2018, several tornadoes swept across northern portions of the lower Mississippi Valley, causing widespread damage, injuries, and unfortunately some fatalities. AccuWeather clients received pinpointed SkyGuard warnings, providing them actionable information and more lead time than what was given by the government's weather service in issuing public warnings and other weather providers who rely on government warnings. All AccuWeather's press releases shared a couple of problems. One, there was no easy way to confirm them, as the forecasts were private and the clients unnamed, and two, even if true, they didn't mean very much. A company selling private tornado warnings can choose the predictions on which it is judged. When it outperforms the National Weather Service, it issues a press release bragging about its prowess. When it is outperformed by the National Weather Service, it can lay low. But it is bound to be better at least every now and then. The dumb blackjack player is sometimes going to beat the card counter. You have these anecdotes from AccuWeather, but there is no data that says they are fundamentally improving on the National Weather Service tornado forecasts, says David Kenny, chief executive of the Weather Company, a subsidiary of IBM, which, among other things, forecasts turbulence for most of the U.S. commercial airline industry. The closest thing to an authority on the relative accuracy of various weather forecasts is a website called Forecast Advisor. It began, as so much weather research seems to, almost by accident. Its founder, Eric Flohr, was managing a team of software developers and went looking for material on which to practice a new programming language. He stumbled upon weather forecasts, and a funny situation. All the forecasters were claiming to be better than each other. They couldn't all be right. When I started in 2003, the private weather companies, AccuWeather, for example, are saying, "We're the number one forecast." So I called them and said, "You make this claim that you were the most accurate forecast. What are you basing it on?" They faxed me back an undergraduate paper written for a science fair that looked at forecasts for 3 months of one summer in Washington, D.C. That was the best data they had to make that claim. Over the next 13 years, Flohr collected 800 million weather forecasts. I was curious, was there really a difference? I live in Paducah, Kentucky. Should I look at AccuWeather or the Weather Channel? Lo and behold, there really was a difference. In the seemingly simple matter of predicting the high temperature for the day, some forecasters were better than others. None of them was consistently better all the time, however. Some were more accurate in some parts of the country than they were in others. Some were more accurate in some months of the year than in others. And there was no answering the question of who was better at tornado alerts or hurricane track predictions or flood warnings, or at calling other life-threatening weather, because the private companies did not reveal their predictions of those events to anyone but their paying customers. So Flohr analyzed everyone's ability to predict the high temperature on any given day. From 2003 up until 2011, the National Weather Service's forecasts had been as good as the most accurate private weather forecast, including AccuWeather's. Since 2011, the private weather forecasters have been slightly more accurate than the National Weather Service. Still, says Flohr, "For sure I'm going to listen to the National Weather Service when they issue a tornado warning or a flash flood warning. I'm not going to trust right now AccuWeather or the Weather Channel." Flohr's analysis uncovered two big trends in weather prediction. One was toward greater relative accuracy in the private sector,
which of course was totally dependent on the National Weather Service data for its forecasts. The other was the astonishing improvement in all weather predictions. The five-day-out forecast in 2016 was as accurate as the one-day-out forecast had been in 2005. In just the last few years, for the first time in history, a meteorologist's forecast of how hot it will be 9 days from now is better than just guessing. Barry Myers liked to say that he was in competition with the federal government. If so, the competition was bizarre. The U.S. Department of Commerce gave him, for free, most of the raw material he needed to create his product. Without the weather satellites, weather radar, weather buoys, and weather balloons, there would be no weather forecasting worth listening to, much less paying for. Whatever AccuWeather and any other private weather forecaster might be doing to refine the National Weather Service's forecasts also depended on having those forecasts in the first place. If the Weather Service forecast wasn't there, all the private weather forecasts would get worse, said David Kenney. But the National Weather Service was forbidden by law from advertising the value of its services, and if it even hinted at doing so, Barry Myers could apply pressure on it in all manner of ways. AccuWeather might make any sort of wild boast it wanted to about the accuracy of its weather prediction. It might disparage the very people who supplied it with the information it had used to make that prediction. The meteorologists at the National Weather Service had no real ability or even inclination to respond. We had to drag them kicking and screaming into defending themselves against false charges, says a former Obama Commerce Department official. They never claim credit. They always do these intensely self-critical, how can we do better inquiries. It's a public safety mentality. They do what they do because they really sincerely, and since they were 8 years old, love the science and the service, not because they care at all about credit or glory. That was the sad truth. The public servants couldn't or wouldn't defend themselves, and few outside the U.S. government had a deep interest in sticking up for them. By the 1990s, Barry Myers was arguing with a straight face that the National Weather Service should be, with one exception, entirely forbidden from delivering any weather-related knowledge to any American who might otherwise wind up a paying customer of AccuWeather. The exception was when human life and property was at stake. Even here, Myers hedged. The National Weather Service does not need to have the final say on warnings, he told the consulting firm McKinsey, which made a study of the strangely fraught relationship between the private weather sector and the government. The customer and the private sector should be able to sort that out. The government should get out of the forecasting business. In 2005, Rick Santorum, a senator from AccuWeather's home state of Pennsylvania and a recipient of Myers family campaign contributions, introduced a bill that would have written this idea into law. The bill was a little vague, but it appeared to eliminate the National Weather Service's website or any other means of communication with the public. It allowed the Weather Service to warn people about the weather just before it was about to kill them, but at no other time. And exactly how anyone would be any good at predicting extreme weather if he or she wasn't predicting all the other weather was left unclear. Pause a moment to consider the audacity of that maneuver. A private company, whose weather predictions were totally dependent on the billions of dollars spent by the U.S. taxpayer to gather the data necessary for those predictions, and on decades of intellectual weather work sponsored by the U.S. taxpayer, and on international data sharing treaties made on behalf of the U.S. taxpayer, and on the very forecasts that the National Weather Service generated, was, in effect, trying to force the U.S. taxpayer to pay all over again for what the National Weather Service might be able to tell him or her for free. After Santorum's bill failed to pass, AccuWeather's strategy appeared, to those inside the Weather Service, to change. Myers spent more time interacting directly with the Weather Service. He got himself appointed to various NOAA advisory boards. He gave an AccuWeather board seat to Conrad Lautenbacher, who had run NOAA in the second Bush administration. He became an insistent presence in the lives of the people who ran the Weather Service. And wherever he saw them doing something that might threaten his profits, he jumped in to stop it. After the Joplin tornado, the Weather Service set out to build an app to better disseminate warnings to the public. AccuWeather already had a weather app, Myers barked, and the government should not compete with it. Barry Myers is the reason we don't have the app, says a senior National Weather Service official. In 2015, the Weather Company offered to help NOAA put its satellite data in the cloud on servers owned by Google and Amazon. Virtually all the satellite data that came into NOAA wound up in places where no one could ever see it again. The Weather Company simply sought to render it accessible to the public. Myers threatened to sue the Weather Service if they did it. "He stopped it," said David Kenny. "We were willing to donate the technology to NOAA for free. We just wanted to do a science project to prove that we could." Myers claimed that, by donating its time and technology to the U.S. government, the Weather Company might somehow gain a commercial advantage. The real threat to AccuWeather here was that many more people would have access to weather data. "It would have been a leap forward for all the people who have the computing power to do forecasts," said Kenny. One senior official at the Department of Commerce at the time was struck by how far this one company in the private sector had intruded into what was, in the end, a matter of public safety. "You're essentially taking a public good that's been paid for with taxpayer dollars and restricting it to the privileged few who want to make money off it," he said. By early 2018, Barry Myers had, by some mysterious process, gotten himself one Senate floor vote away from running NOAA. How he went about trying to secure that vote was deeply disturbing, at least in the eyes of the U.S. Senate staffers vetting his nomination. "We don't hear much from the White House," said one, "but the AccuWeather lobbyist is up here all the time. It's almost like it, NOAA, has been subcontracted to him, which is bizarre. It's Trump saying, if it is worth it to you, go get it. Normally the White House would be doing this." Myers, for his part, was evasive. During the confirmation process, he was asked to name the people who sat on the AccuWeather board. Myers declined. The information belonged to the company and wasn't his own to disclose, he indicated. But just a short time earlier, in a private meeting, he had rattled the names off easily. Several of them were members of his family. He claimed he would sell his stake in AccuWeather, but did not explain how or to whom. "He says he's going to sell his AccuWeather shares, but he could sell it to his brother for a dollar and buy it back for a dollar when he leaves office," says Walter Schaub, former head of the Office of Government Ethics. In his bizarre competition with the National Weather Service, there were two ways for Barry Myers to win. His family business might consistently make better weather forecasts and earn the trust of paying customers through its virtuosity. Or it could make the National Weather Service forecasts worse, or at least less accessible. As a private citizen, Myers devoted considerable energy to making the National Weather Service seem worse. As a public servant, he could do much more. "Barry is uniquely dangerous in a way Scott Pruitt is not," said a Senate staffer. "Scott Pruitt does not understand the agency, environmental protection, he's trying to destroy. Barry's skills make him more effective in dismantling NOAA. There are a million little things he could do that we will never understand." Another McKinsey study estimated that the entire industry generated somewhere between $2 billion and $4 billion a year in revenue and was growing fast, with reason. The annual cost of natural disasters in the 1980s had been $50 billion. Hurricane Sandy alone inflicted over $65 billion worth of damage. The private weather industry, unlike the National Weather Service, has a financial interest in catastrophe. The more spectacular and expensive the disasters, the more people will pay for warning of them. The more people stand to lose, the more money they will be inclined to pay. The more they pay, the more the weather industry can afford to donate to elected officials, and the more influence it will gain over the political process. The dystopic endgame is not difficult to predict. The day you get only the weather forecast you pay for. A private company will become better than the Weather Service at knowing where a hurricane will make landfall. What will it do with that information? Tell the public or trade it inside a hedge fund? You know what Hurricane Harvey is going to do to Houston before Houston knows. Do you help Houston? Or do you find clever ways to make money off Houston's destruction? One version of the future revealed itself in March 2015. The National Weather Service had failed to spot a tornado before it struck Moore, Oklahoma. It had spun up and vanished very quickly, but still, the people in the Weather Service should have spotted it. AccuWeather quickly issued a press release bragging that it had sent a tornado alert to its paying corporate customers in Moore 12 minutes before the tornado hit. The big point is that AccuWeather never broadcasts its tornado warning. The only people who received it were the people who had paid for it, and God help those who hadn't. While the tornado was touching down in Moore, AccuWeather's network channel was broadcasting videos of hippos swimming. When at the request of the Trump White House, the former Bush Commerce Department official wrote up his list of people he believed were suited to run the National Ocean